Hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler. Happy First Friday. I hope you had a distinguished or at least distinctive Day of the Dead. Stick around and you'll hear a very interesting conversation with Caitlin Doty, this nation's doyen of death. But first, music meeting number 5. KD&K Assistant Music Director Cody Lee will talk about Willie Watson. KD&K General Manager Gavin Dahl brings El Javi to the table. And my choice, Lucas Nelson and the Promise of the Real. And that's who we start with on music meeting number 5.
Well, it's only been 2 years and she already hates my dog. She's been up and down the street like she don't understand the law. And I'm pining for some time where I ain't looking at her face. And every time she talks to me, I'm staring into space and I get antsy. Commitment seems absurd. Well, out here in the country, forever is a four-letter word.
Lucas Nelson and Promise of the Real from their self-titled new CD. I chose that one. That is a four-letter word because the boy's got a sense of humor.
Oh, man, it's so good to be back for another music meeting. I'm so glad we're doing this.
Here we are. And hi, Cody.
Hello.
Welcome back.
We're back.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. I love this new Lucas Nelson record. I'm so glad you picked it for this.
Yeah, and we're going to try a little something different. That was just an excerpt of one song, and we'll probably do an excerpt of another one, and then a full tune after that. But this one is just such an accomplished CD. I mean, Lucas and his band, Lucas, of course, is Willie Nelson's son, and he and his band have, for the last 2 years, been the backing band for Neil Young. And I talked I checked out the website, his website, and discovered that he has a lot of great things. I wanted to share this quote with him, with you. I wanted to get the songs as pure as they could be. We owe a lot to Neil. We made this record after coming off the road with him for 2 years. Neil's been mentoring us, and we've been absorbing that energy, and I think it shows. We got acclimated to a different level of artistic expression. We've grown, and you can really see it. You know, the guy's only 28, but this is a masterpiece. Is it possible to have a masterpiece at that age?
It is a really fine production, Luke. I would agree.
Let's try an excerpt from Forget About Georgia.
Oh, a part of me hopes she'll never forget about me. A part of me hopes she'll never forget about me.
Majestic.
Yeah, you can really hear that attention to detail in the production of this album, I think.
And that long guitar solo lasts for a couple more minutes. So he's unafraid to take on the lead guitar solo, that's for sure. I'm just so impressed with this album. There's humor in it. There's Roadhouse Stomp. There's Profound Ruminations, and that's the one I want to play the whole track from. Similar to that, there's just really good writing, great singing. He's got a crack band. They've obviously put in their time. I'm just so impressed.
Such
with
a
this.
Cosmic sound.
Yeah, it's... cosmic country.
Do you know how many guys are in the band?
Six,
oh,
including Lucas, and three of them are original. They've been with him all 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah,
10 years.
So, should we try the whole song? I love this one. It's the last on the album. It's called If I Started Over.
What if we had to start over? What if the end never ends? What if our lives are not a straight line? Infinite faces, infinite minds. What if we all are just dreaming? How would we deal with our pain? Would we be playing these sad little games, destined to come here again and again? And why are you on my mind? It's that feeling again, like when I first looked in your eyes. If I started over, I'd welcome you in. I wouldn't be scared if I started over. I'd find you again. What if we all are just dreaming? What if we're ruled by our screens? What if emotions are chemical games? Why am I here? And why do I sing? And why are you on my mind? It's that feeling again, like when I first looked in your eyes. If I started over, I'd find you again. I'd find you again.
Definitely hears Papa's voice.
Yeah, definitely. And you know that last excerpt, he took off with the guitar, and on that song he took off with his voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just so impressed.
And beautiful steel guitar work in the background.
You can tell they're well practiced.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They're tight.
Yeah, I love it, man. And it's not even a genre that I've spent, deep listening hours to, and everything I've heard from this record is just top notch. I think it's got to be up there best of the year for sure.
You know, there's one or two releases that I can truthfully put on the label for the DJs play all, and this one was definitely one of them. Yeah, play all.
Yes.
Play any, play all.
I like that whenever that happens.
Yeah. So, Cody, you brought to the table Willie Watson. Tell me about Willie Watson.
Oh, I think this is good timing, Luke, because this is my favorite Americana album of the year so far, produced by David Rawlings, actually. And Willie Watson, as a lot of you know, was one of the founding members of Old Crow Medicine Show, and he stepped out to do his own stuff a few years ago. And I guess I read that crowds were a little more responsive to the traditional songs that he played rather than what he was writing himself. And I'm more into the instrumentation and the melodies more than the writing anyway. So I just think that these renditions of these old-time songs are as good as it gets as far as I'm concerned. And really special feature on this album is the Fairfield Four, who originally formed in Nashville in 1921. These are not the original members, but these guys have been singing together since the 1950s. And they had sort of a breakout on the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou album. They won a Grammy for that. So these guys are singing with Willie on this song, and this album's called Folk Singer Volume 2.
Well, I want that man or woman to tell the reason why.
Why?
That woman's evil, do things on the sly. You come home, you want your supper to be hot. She never put a neck bone in the pot. She's on the road again.
Sure you won't.
Natural born Eastman on the road again. On that road again.
Oh, sure you born.
Natural born Eastman on the road again. Well, I went to my window, my window was propped. I went to my door, man, my door was locked. I stepped right back, shook my head, and there's a big old fella in my folding bed. I shot through the window, broke the glass. I never seen another fella run so fast. Hey. On that road again.
Sure you're born.
Natural born Eastman on the road again. On that road again.
Oh. Sure you're born.
Natural born Eastman on the road again. Said he wants his hat. Said he wants to know where your husband's at.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's on his way to the pen. So come on, pretty mama, let's get on that road again. On that road again.
Sure you're born.
Natural born Eastman on the road again. On that road again.
Oh, sure you're born.
Natural born Eastman on the road again. On that road.
Born Eastman on the road again.
On that road again.
Ooh.
Natural born Eastman on the road again.
On the road again. Willie Watson said he got that from the Memphis Jug Band, but it's just an old traditional song.
Feels like a time warp when you hear that, you know. I can't believe that's a current record.
Yeah, right.
Is that a euphemism? Getting on the road again, because he was talking. Part of the lyric was, "Where's your husband? He's gone. Let's get on the road again."
Oh, yeah, maybe.
I don't know, because you had to be careful back in those days with that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
You had to speak in euphemistic terms.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's really cool. That gospel harmony in the background is killer.
Yeah, and I think it's so stripped down compared to the Lucas Nelson, right? But that's what I really like. It's just guys' voices and a guitar, right?
I didn't realize he was part of Old Crow Medicine Show.
Originally. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's a major step to leave a band like that and go solo.
Yeah, You know, I realize that I like Old Crow better when they had his voice as the front man. I really like Willie Watson's voice, and I've heard a few other fans say that, and that they sort of went after a different kind of sound when he left. It sounds to me like they're a little more dressed up on their last few albums.
And he went in the other direction.
Yeah, I guess so.
Do you think he'll write original stuff? Or
well,
think?
That's what I was saying is that in reading about him, it seems like he sort of tried and that wasn't as fulfilling.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So he's a purist.
I guess.
That's awfully sweet stuff. Willie Watson. What's the name of the CD?
Folk Singer Volume 2. Pretty cool. Generic.
Have you heard
title.
Volume 1?
No, I haven't heard Volume. Well, no, I have heard a few songs from it, but that came out in 2014, and I wasn't real hip to that when it came out here at KD&K.
Yeah, I wasn't either. And look at all those spins.
Yeah.
It's still at the top of our charts.
It really is. Yeah. That's true. As is Lucas Nelson.
Yep. Well, Gavin, who are you bringing?
You know, I have a unique pick for me. I don't know much about flamenco music and have really kind of fallen head over heels for this new record from El Javi. He's from Mexico City, based out of Denver, and his new album is called A Gypsy Journey Part 2, El Refugio, and this one's called Summerland. Is called Summerland by El Javi, and I had a really amazing experience checking him out recently at The Temporary, the new venue in Basalt or Willits, and a really great little space and fantastic place to do an intimate set like that. He kept commenting that so many shows he's played have been so loud that there were certain songs he couldn't play when he does a free show at a bar or something like that. And so the crowd was so rapt and everyone was, you know, hanging off his every strum that, you know, it really made a unique appearance, I think, for him as well. And I was expecting to go in there and see El Javi with his drummer. But he said just recently they were playing in Mexico and flew back through Houston International Airport. I think that's the George Bush Airport. And his drummer got deported for visa issues. But I'll tell you, part of the thing about El Javi that's so impressive is that the way he adapted to do a solo performance, he did one song where he used a looping pedal and he set up rhythm tracks with the guitar and then played over them. So he played one piece and then hit the pedal and then played over that and then hit the pedal again. And then he did all of his licks over a bass, you know, a bass of a core of the song that he had laid down live in front of us with the looping pedal. And then he had a couple other tracks where he had all of the percussion, you know, just off of, you know, some sort of a device, an iPad or something. And so then played with that percussion and it worked, you know, it really held up live. And he's got a Denver connection now. He's sort of based in Colorado, but from Mexico City. And I think kind of trying to compete for, he wants to be called the king of rock flamenco. So that's kind of his next big goal is to be, you know, to grow this idea of rock flamenco. And I try to think of what else I've heard that's like El Javi. And I guess kind of Rodrigo y Gabriela is probably the closest I've come to something similar with a, you know, mix of sort of Spanish guitar with Mexican influences and then, you know, the
a sort of contemporary, like,
right,
stomping rock.
Yeah, and then he did the Beatles. He did Led Zeppelin. Uh-huh. But he turned them into, like, this rock flamenco, and people were just blown away. And one singer-songwriter in the seats next to me said at the end, he's like, it just makes you want to give up when you see someone play that well. But I don't know. It was really... it was really an impressive live set, and the recording's very smooth. I mean, it's almost a little smoother than I would want. You know, I think that it'll be interesting to see as he moves forward what direction he goes into the kind of Starbucks, you know, checkout aisle or the real kind of international flavor. And he has these basement sessions later on in the record that are a little more sparse, which I think I like a little bit more for the production aspect myself. But, you know, it's sort of interesting talking about Lucas Nelson and Willie Watson. It's like two very distinct sounds that they're going for. And he's kind of somewhere in the middle, I think.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a traditional flamenco performance with a dancer?
Only on TV, never in person.
So stunning.
Yeah, you felt like this thing could grow from, you know, a solo or a duo type performance into a full band. And he certainly has horns and other things on the record too.
Well, I know he started off pretty basic as a flamenco artist, like straight up flamenco. This new one, I think this is his newest one.
Mm-hmm.
He's got four or five before this, and pretty straight up flamenco.
And he's been based out of Colorado for a while?
I don't know.
I mean, he's definitely from Mexico City, and his drummer's from Spain. I was actually really looking forward to chatting with his drummer because I wanted to get his take on the whole Catalonia independence issue that's so big in the news this fall. But I think that his Denver connections. He's done a few appearances on public television and stuff. So with Open Media Foundation and the City of Denver Channel 8 and stuff. So I think he's laying down some Denver roots and then traveling the world. I know he's doing a Texas tour this fall and playing some international festivals. So definitely on the map and someone that we're really glad to have in the KD&K Music Library.
Heck yeah.
And also happy to see them coming to the Valley to play at the Temporary.
Yep, Temporary's continuing to add more great bookings, and we hope to collaborate with them too and actually partner for KD&K events. So more on that to come for sure. And hey, another music meeting in the books, guys. This is so fun.
Lucas Nelson, Willie Watson, El Javi.
The guitar episode.
Thanks, guys.
Mix it up for next time.
All right, stay with me. There is more to come. Caitlin Doty coming right up. But before we get to that, let's listen to Cody Canada and The Departed here with a tune called Staring Down the Sun. The former frontman for Cross Canadian Ragweed brings his band to the Ute Theater in Rifle tonight. And if you want to go, I have a pair of tickets for you. Call me here in the studio at 963-2976, and I will hook you up. Well, Caitlin Doughty dedicates her new book to her parents and all parents who let the weird kids be weird. She may be weird, but she is all grown up now, and she's the author of two bestsellers, the creator of her own YouTube channel called Ask the Mortician, with hundreds of thousands of views, and she has legions of admirers that she calls Deathlings. She's funny, she's smart, and I caught up with her last Tuesday, which of course was Halloween. Sadly, though, Caitlin Doughty was too busy and tired to dress up and go out last Tuesday. I guess that's what happens when you become a star. So anyway, let's check out Caitlin Doughty with a new book called From Here to Eternity, here on KDNK's Express Yourself. Caitlin Doughty, welcome to KDNK.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking because you have a brand new book. It is called From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death.
It is. And that's what it is. It's wanting to see other cultures around the world and how they handle death, which might look very different than how we handle death in the United States.
So you did find a good death?
Well, I don't know. Good death is hard, and it's even harder now. This has come up a lot recently with so many bad deaths around the world. It's hard to define the good death anymore, but I think the good death is really a death that you're prepared for and a death that you have some ritual around or some way to handle the body that makes you feel like you've truly grieved and truly mourned and come out the other side.
And you found numerous ways that people around the world have done that. You traveled to 8 different places around the world, or at least you write about 8 different places around the world, including 3 in this country. Well, since we're on the eve of the Day of the Dead, why don't we start by what you found in Mexico? Describe the scene for me.
Right. Well, what was so interesting about Mexico to me is the idea of Day of the Dead. We consider it iconic in Mexico, and we consider it the Mexican understanding of death is the idea of this time of year where the veil between the living and the dead is thinned, and people can come back and visit, and the family makes offerings and remembers the people who have died, and the flowers and the candles and the colors. And in reality, in the 1970s, it had faded away to pretty much just the rural areas of Mexico. And the elites in Mexico City were thinking, oh, this is a thing that the rabble practice way outside of the city. We don't practice this. But Halloween was creeping down from the United States, and the intellectuals also didn't like the idea of taking up the mantle of the witches and the goblins and the spooks and the pumpkins from the commercialized American Halloween. So they brought back Dia de los Muertos. They brought back Day of the Dead to Mexico City. And since then, even places that never really practiced it before have taken on Day of the Dead as almost this national identity in Mexico. And when you go there for Day of the Dead now, it's so everywhere you go, there are parades and elaborate installations and altars and this really very, very public connection with the dead.
And that, you're saying, is found in urban areas as well as rural.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things that I found is when I arrived there a few days before Dia de los Muertos started, there was this massive parade going through the main boulevard in Mexico City, one of the main boulevards in Mexico City, and it was just thousands and thousands of people and giant skeleton floats going down the streets and people in Aztec costume on rollerblades zooming around and brides and grooms and skeletal face dancing through the streets. And it was so elaborate. And you've seen this parade before in the James Bond movie, Spectre. And so my perception was, oh, okay, this was a movie that, you know, that featured this parade that they have in Mexico City. No, it turns out that was the first year they had had the parade, and it was based on the James Bond movie. The government had seen the James Bond movie and decided that people are going to think there's this elaborate parade when there isn't one. So they spent the money and all the volunteers to create this spectacle, and it just shows how much Mexico and the tourism board and government are proud to be connected with death and want people to see Mexico as this place that's very aware of death and engaged with death, and it's part of their national identity.
You actually observed a Day of the Dead, I don't know if I'd call it ritual or ceremony, in a graveyard, in a cemetery. And reading that description of it, well, first of all, you write, walking into the cemetery on the evening of November 1st was nothing short of revelatory. And the way you wrote about it brought the scene to life. I wonder if you could describe that a little bit for our listeners.
It really was. It's one of the most incredible moments of my life. It was, you walk into this cemetery and all of these families have spent or have saved up all year to be able to afford all of the candles and food and decorations for their loved one's grave. And they sit at the grave and they light some of them thousands of candles. And they sit there and they, you know, cuddle up in blankets and they light little fires and there's music playing and there are live bands going from grave to grave. And it's all bound in by the barriers of the cemetery, the wrought iron fence of the cemetery. And you just feel so a part of something. And it just, the candles just make the whole cemetery glow in the night. You could probably see it from space. And just the love and the openness about their grief and the openness about saying that, yeah, we never forget the people who have died. Which, you know, in the U.S., we tend to say, oh, if it's been a week and you're not back at work and you're not over it, it's time to get over it. But that's not the way they're handling it in Mexico. They're saying, yeah, grief is an ongoing relationship that lasts many years, and being a part of that was just a complete privilege.
You also quote a Mexican writer in that chapter as saying that Mexicans have powers of healing, and of healing what is certainly the U.S.'s most painfully chronic ailment, its denial of death and its abandonment of the bereaved to a kind of solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm. I write about a very close friend of mine and colleague of mine, Sarah, who is Mexican-American, and she lost a child in a very tragic way and was haunted by it, as you can imagine, and nobody really wanted to talk to her about it. She felt like she was being a bummer every time she brought it up. And being able to go back to Mexico and go back to her cultural heritage and see how open they were. We passed these graves where it would be also dead infants, and the parents would still be there years later. And even if they had new children, if they had other children, and they were still there at the grave, and they were still saying, "Hey, we're proud of our son, And even though he died, he's still our son. And that's really what Sarah was looking for. She was looking to be able to be open about the fact that she had this child that wasn't with her anymore. And she made the really good point that parents love nothing more than to show off their children. That's what social media is, you know, built around almost, is this idea of how proud parents are of their kids. And when a child dies, you're not allowed to do that anymore, especially in America. So to be there for Day of the Dead, where people were so open about their grief for their child, was really healing for her, I think.
Yes, very cathartic. And I have to say that including her in your narrative, I think, personalized it in a way that was completely effective.
Thank you. And I was really grateful. I wasn't expecting her to tell me the whole story and the gritty details of the story. And I often asked her, I said, you know, is this okay? Can I really share this? And in a way, it's part of her advocacy now. It's part of her advocacy to say, yeah, I want to be open about how my child died, why he died, how it felt when he died, how I felt like I didn't have much support when he died, emotionally or grieving or in my community. And I do think that's really important, because we don't talk about miscarriages or abortions or the death of a child with the openness that we should.
Let's talk a little bit about what you found in Indonesia. They have a rather unusual way of dealing with their dead. Maybe you could describe that for us.
Sure. When someone dies in this rural area of South Sulawesi in Indonesia, they mummify them. And the old way they used to do that is with teas and tannins and almost like tanning in leather. But now they have somebody come in from the village and stick formalin or formaldehyde in the body like an American embalmer would. And they keep the body in the home, sometimes for several years while they're preparing for the funeral. And then even after they bury the dead, they will still bring them out every 3 years or so to redress them and talk to them about how they're doing and what's changed in the village, and take family portraits with their mummified grandmother. And to an American, this seems pretty out there. This seems very Norman Bates. This seems very psycho. But to them, it's normal. And I have to say that once you've been there for a little while, it starts to feel normal. And you see that they're interacting with their dead. And something that some people ask me all the time is they want to know, okay, so my dad died 12 years ago in upstate New York, and he was embalmed and he was buried. What does his body look like now? And people always want to know that. And I don't have a great answer normally, because there are so many different factors. But it's fascinating to me that here's a culture that actually checks up on their dead. They see how they're doing. They see what the body looks like 10 years later. And they know, so they're not left to their own imagination. So in that case, if people want to know, is it that weird that they do know and that they take out their mummified dead?
And you make the point that seeing mom again in this altered state, quote, might be less frightening than the specters of the human imagination, unquote.
Exactly. If you're thinking about your dead dad in upstate New York and what his body must be like trapped underneath the ground, and is it a mummy, is it a skeleton, what is it? You know, it's not like you're not thinking about these things. Some people don't, but some people really do, and they really worry about it and they really fixate on it. And for me, somebody who, to be fair, has become incredibly comfortable with the dead body just because of the work that I do, for me, it seems like, yeah, let's just take a peek. Let's peek in. Let's see how mom is. Oh, look, she's pretty skeletonized. Isn't that interesting? And for some people, again, that's horrifying. But for some people, you know, who really do suffer with not knowing and this sense of ill ease around what's happened to someone's body, I think this could be a comforting thing. I'm not suggesting that America is going to turn to long-term mummification and taking our mummies out of the grave. That's not going to happen. But I do think that we can be a lot more open with what happens to the dead body, what it's going to look like, even just being around it after the person dies. We have a real discomfort with that we can learn a lot from these other cultures.
Well, you learned a lot from your trip to Japan, and it was also very instructive for me, because you weren't so much immersed in an indigenous culture. It was very high tech. Maybe you could speak a little bit about a couple of the places you found in Japan and how they deal with death there.
What's so interesting about Japan for me is really exactly what you just said, the fact that, you know, it's easy to almost dismiss what they're doing in this rural mountainous area of Indonesia where they're rice farmers, because you can go, oh, that's fascinating, but that's not my life. That has no connection to my world. But in Japan, it's a very urban, high-tech, developed country that has a lot of the same issues that we have in our big cities in America. And I think that they've addressed them with regards to the dead much more admirably than our American funeral industry has. And so, for example, they still spend time with the dead body. They still have their rituals with the dead body. But after the cremation takes place, and it is inevitably a cremation because they have a 99% cremation rate in Japan, which is higher than any other country in the world, after the cremation takes place, they have all these new interesting ways to keep the cremated remains. So, for example, there's a light-up columbarium where you go in. It's in this old Buddhist temple, but then you go in and they have a tap card, like on the subway, and 360 degrees of crystal Buddhas light up blue. And your mom's crystal Buddha, which her ashes are behind, lights up white and pulses white, so you can go straight to her crystal Buddha and light some incense and say your prayers and your greetings to her. And then there's another one that's right off the subway that you go in, and you go into this little pod, and there's a gravestone with a hole in the middle. And there's also a tap card like a subway, and boop, 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 and it sends a note back to where all of the cremated remains are kept, and a robot arm grabs your mom and brings her down and puts her in the gravestone. So all of a sudden, her set of ashes is right there in the center, and you can stand in that little pod and light incense and pray again. And when you first hear this, you're going, oh, really? That's kind of tacky, right by the subway. Is that what we want to do? So when you first see this, you're kind of going, oh, this is a little tacky. I don't know if I want to go visit mom on my lunch break right off the subway. But the fact is that land is so scarce there that this is really their opportunity not to have to go 2 or 3 hours outside of the city to do this and to visit mom. And so it actually is this innovation that really works to get people continuing to visit people and they're dead long after the death has occurred.
And that's very valuable for processing grief.
It is, especially for them. It's very, very valuable. Yeah, and I think that they, especially in their culture, it's really important to visit the ashes and really important to visit the burial ground. And so any way that they can make that happen with greater ease benefits them, and it makes them feel like they're doing right by the person who died. And the fact that they use technology to make that happen is just a natural innovation that's happening there, and I think should be happening in the U.S. as well.
You bring up also as a result of what another thing you found in Japan, at a crematorium, I think it is, where the family is asked to pick out the bone fragments from the ashes with chopsticks, no less. And that psychologically, that's an incredibly valuable thing for a family in grief to do because it gives them structure and a purpose.
Exactly. And you wouldn't necessarily think that. But in the U.S., when they pull out the full set of very brittle bones after a cremation, we put it in this big machine called the cremulator, which grinds them up, and you get them back as ashes, what we know of as ashes. But in Japan, they pull out the full skeleton, and the family comes and picks them with chopsticks and puts them in the urn. And this is incredibly interactive, and I think it's a wonderful thing. And you might think it's a little horrifying sounding, but there are stories of people who have gone there from America or, you know, other Western countries and said, actually, this was really nice. This was a really nice ritual, and it was my daughter or it was my husband, and it felt like something I should be doing.
You found in North Carolina a group that is doing experiments in recomposition. Maybe you could describe what recomposition is.
Yes, recomposition is the fancy word that they've decided on for essentially body composting. So the idea is that it would be a replacement for cremation. And instead of putting you into the flames, you would put the body into a wood chip pile. And through a certain amount of time, they're trying to go for about 28 days, the body would be broken down, including the bones, into rich soil. So the entire body, it wouldn't be human remains. The entire body would just be transformed into soil like it would in a compost pile. And then that soil could be used for just a garden in the back of the facility. You could take some home and plant a tree, but it would really be, because they often say, you know, oh, I want to be part of a tree when I die. We'll just put my ashes in a tree. Well, that's a bit of a, you know, it doesn't quite work out that way. Because ashes are entirely inorganic. They're inorganic bone fragments. So you can hope that they won't kill the tree, but they're not really nurturing the tree either.
You make the point that in several places in your text that it's the women that are changing things. That's interesting
to me. Right, yeah, it absolutely is. And I think that women are naturally a little less squeamish around death, and I think there are reasons for that. We have, you know, we have our menstrual cycle. We bleed every month. We're used to the idea of a general, more of a sense of the fact that we are more vulnerable than men to violence. We live with that every day. We have children, which means we bring into the world life, but also something that will die. We give birth to death. And so we have this much more visceral connection with death than men do, I believe. And I think that is showing up in the fact that in so many of these places, women are the ones who are spearheading this difference. They want to take death away from the men who have controlled it. So as you mentioned in Bolivia, it's the Catholic Church and the priests who are necessarily men, and that, you know, they want to have their own way to speak to the beyond, and they use these skulls, these ñatitas, which can help be a conduit to the beyond. Or you have the idea of body composting and the fact that women are making that happen. And maybe it's because we want to be allowed to decompose. We want our bodies to get a little more messy. We don't want to be under the purview of men saying this is what you will or will not do with your body at any given time. And in the funeral industry, women used to be in charge of the dead when they were in the family home. But now that it's a primarily male-dominated industry, it's the men saying, oh, no, this is your bodies, and we'll take them, and then we'll sell them back to you after we've done what's good for them. And women are saying, wait a second, no, we know what's good for our own family members, and we want to take that power back as well. So it's in all these areas you're seeing women do exactly as you said, to stand up and say, we want to take the power back, and we want to be involved with what happens with our own dead.
So I guess the first step on that long road to squeamishness was when the patriarchy arose.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think for America, I really think it was when the American funeral industry began. And that was a 20th century invention, an early 20th century invention. And again, it took away the power from the women in the home who were taking care of the dead and put it on these professional, quote unquote, men who ran the funeral homes.
Huh. That's interesting. Well, I guess then with the rise of women and changes in thinking about death, that might be the precursor to a great big tidal wave of change washing over the planet.
Oh, gosh, I hope so. Your mouth to God's ears, my friend. We'll see.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the epilogue. So you spent, I don't know, how long did you spend traveling around the world?
This was probably about 2.5 years.
So you spent 2.5 years traveling around the world. You observed all these things, and then yet you don't shy away from possible solutions to this squeamishness that we know as Americans. In fact, in your epilogue, you write, 9 years ago, when I began working with the dead, I heard other practitioners speak about holding the space for the dying person and their family. With my secular bias, holding the space sounded like saccharine hippie lingo. This judgment was wrong. Holding the space is crucial and exactly what we are missing. To hold the space is to create a ring of safety around the family and friends of the dead, providing a place where they can grieve openly and honestly without fear of being judged. That's beautiful, Caitlin Doty.
Thank you. And I kind of take us back to what we started talking about, which is in Mexico and the cemetery on Day of the Dead and the glowing candles and the fence that surrounds the cemetery and how it feels like when you step in that cemetery, you're at a place where you can lay down your grief and you can be open about it and you can be honest about it. And it's just so safe in the bounds of that cemetery. And that's what we need in the United States. We don't need more kind of dated-looking funeral homes where you walk by the casket and tap mom's embalmed hand and stand there for a second before taking your seat. We need places where people can really feel how they want to feel, grieve how they want to grieve, be open about it, and just take a moment to be in this separate space that, that death and grief necessitates us being in.
Well, after this investigation, which I think is your life purpose, it sounds like. I mean, this is your second book. Your first book also dealt with some of these issues, and I'm assuming there are more books to come. I wonder if your investigations have given you a definitive way for dealing with your own body when you die.
Well, my dream is to be laid out to be eaten by animals, because I ate animals during my life, and they should have their turn with me when I die. But that's not exactly legal in the United States yet. So I just want a natural burial. I want a hole dug in the ground and my body, my shrouded body, put a couple feet beneath the earth in the topsoil and let nature do its work.
So your friends and family will carry you up to Mount Whitney and someplace away from the prying eyes of Big Brother?
Exactly. Well, that's, you know, if I told you that, I'd have to kill you.
Oh,
if I told you my death plan, I'd have to kill you, ironically. But no, yeah, I won't say if we're doing anything off the beaten legal path or anything, but I will say that I do want my family involved, and I do want it to be very natural, and I want my body to go back to nature.
Before I let you go, Caitlin, I have to ask, I watched several of your videos, which are not only funny, but informative. And I guess you have a YouTube channel devoted to it, Ask a Mortician. Talk a little bit about Ask a Mortician, because I really want people to check this stuff out. It's worth it.
Yeah, thank you. We put out a video every week now, and it's been going on for quite a few years. But it's only growing in pop. It's growing in popularity now more than ever before. And I think there's just something that people are hungry for this. They want to hear about death. They want to hear about real death. They want to hear about famous corpses around the world, behind the scenes, at a funeral home. They're so interested in this information. And I think at this point, I've gotten pretty good at delivering the information in a way that's funny, so you get into it, but is also non-threatening and also respectful. And I hope that I strike that tone in the middle there. And that's the goal of the channel. And give it a shot. It'll make death a little more fun than you think is possible.
Well, yeah, and you'll learn something. Not only will you laugh, but I watched the one on the Salem witch trials, and you obviously did your research, and I discovered from watching it some things that I didn't know about. So, you know, good on you.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
And then last but not least, you are the proprietor or the director, I guess, of Undertaking LA, which is a nonprofit alternative funeral home. That's not really something that you normally hear about. Tell me a little bit about a nonprofit funeral home.
Exactly. Our idea with Undertaking LA is that we want, first of all, everyone in the community to be able to use us, regardless of finances. And we also want people to come to us who want to be more involved with the death, whether it's keeping the body at home, whether it's having a wake at home, whether it's coming to help us dress the body, and then hopefully ending up with a natural burial.
Do you think this attitude is spreading around the funeral industry in the United States?
I sure do. I mean, I'm a little biased because it's my own advocacy, so I see it everywhere, but I really do think that it is, and I think that people aren't really happy with the status quo and what it's been for years and years, and they want more natural options, they want simpler options, they want more engaged options, and they're starting to demand it all around the country.
Very interesting. Well, Caitlin Doty, all the best of luck to you. What a fascinating read, From Here to Eternity. And thank you for talking to us here on KD&K.
Of course. Such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I really urge you to check out her YouTube channel. I've watched 10 or 12 of them, and I think I'm going to have to plow my way through all of them. Really interesting stuff. That brings to the end another Express Yourself. Thank you for listening. Please remember to go out there and express yourself.